Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 2nd, 1999. And in the location of the fireside room this morning is Wes Howard Brook. And today's session number is 99-10. And it is titled Coming Out of Empire Today. Let's listen in to his presentation.
Present an end of the world scenario. Present Revelation as if it's a blueprint for the end times. Try to come to grips with its difficult message and how that has relevance for us today. So we talked about that, how that works and why it appeals some last week. And then as the grounding for alternative reading, I tried to provide some tools for both from the Bible itself, from Hebrew Scripture, and about the first century world of the Christians in the cities of the Roman province of Asia to show how this text was meant to speak a powerful message to them. And the central message of it was to learn to see apocalyptically, which in its root sense is to lift the veil, apocalypto, to reveal what is hidden. And that John's vision on its face in the very first verses claims to be something that he got in a vision from an angel who got it from Jesus, who got it from God. So it's one of the only New Testament texts that it claims explicitly to be the Word of God. Most are only that implicitly by being within the canon. So however we, in our own discernment, interpret the fact that it's in the canon or the fact that John claims to have a vision, it's a message to its original audience claiming to tell them what God thinks about the world and what their world appears to be from a divine perspective. And the long and short of that is that John looked out at the world of the Roman Empire and saw Babylon, saw the great city, as it's described in the Bible, as far back as Genesis 10, the place in which humans gather apart from God, to gather power against God. That what, by its own terms in the Roman Empire, claimed to be the great civilizing force, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome, that provided pax et securitas, as Paul refers to it in 1 Thessalonians, peace and security, and to be the only divinely inspired way of living, John saw it as a smoking ruin, the city of Babylon fallen already. Not something, as the apocalyptic predecessors in the book of Daniel saw, as something that would fall sometime and your mission was to hang in there until it fell, trusting that God would eventually prove to be more powerful. But that from the apocalyptic perspective, Babylon was already fallen. And the issue is, why would you want to live amidst a ruined city? Now that was obviously spoken in a world in which the Roman Empire at the surface appeared to be in charge. And it was spoken to people who are a tiny minority within these powerful cities, struggling within a place where the signs of imperial cult and the imperial economy were just the fabric of daily life. In contrast with this image of Babylon Empire was the image of New Jerusalem, the holy city, which comes down out of heaven. Slightly ironically, in light of our forum last night about heaven and hell, where people refer to heaven, with the imagery of pearly gates, etc., Revelation, just on its surface, even if you don't know anything about its world, says that the gates of pearl, not the pearly gates, are the gates of the city New Jerusalem, which comes out of heaven. Not heaven, it comes out of heaven, which is a curious thing. So part of it is just we need to learn to read carefully, and it's also helpful to have some background. So yesterday we looked at New Jerusalem, and we looked centrally at what it was saying in terms of the role of the church, which I've been trying to use the original Greek term ekklesia, which I keep hearing pronounced ecclesia. If you remember one thing here, it's ekklesia, and plural is ekklesiae, not ecclesiae. Pedantic point, but I felt the need to make it since I'm sitting here. That the role of the ecclesia was not simply to be a place where you go for an hour for worship, but to be the basis for an alternative society, where the role of worship and singing as defined within, is revealed within the heavenly scenes of liturgy, was like the manifesto of this alternative society. And economics and politics grounded in the covenant and the gospel. Grounded in sabbatical and jubilee, those images from Leviticus and from other parts of the Torah where God called up people out from empire, Persia, Egypt, and from other empires throughout history to live with God at the center, trusting in the abundance of God and with respect and dignity for all persons. Okay? And what I'm going to advise you to do after a moment today is do a little brainstorming and sharing, and not surprisingly, I have a few thoughts of my own on this, about where is Empire of Babylon today? Where is Heaven or New Jerusalem today? And again, just to, while you're getting your gears turning on that, I just want to underscore something that we looked at earlier this week in terms of worship. Hardly anybody in our culture would say they worship Satan. So one of the tricky things here in looking at what is Babylon today, what is the place of false worship, is to say, well, we don't worship all these things. They don't claim to be religious, entities. They don't claim to be God. And yet, John's vision says that worship of the beast, this is in Revelation 13, is manifested through several specific things, none of which on the face seem to be worship. One is that cry in Revelation 13:5 of who is like the beast and who can fight against him. That's one that we're very susceptible to in our culture, and it's just part of human finitude and smallness in the face of some of the powerful agglomerations of political and military and economic power that humans have been faced with for all history. So Revelation is suggesting it's an implicit form of worship to look out at empire and feel powerless. Feel that our faith in the Creator does not empower us to resist, but that we're helpless. That feeling of helplessness and despair is a form of worship, even though an ugly and not affirmative form of worship. The second, again from Revelation 13, is about this business of the mark of the beast in the hand required to buy or sell. And I hope that you'll see that this is key to understanding it in our world. What John is saying there, as we looked at, was that participating in the imperial economy of the Roman Empire was implicitly worshiping the beast and the dragon from whom the beast gets power, Satan. Now, ordinary people, Christians or otherwise, didn't think when they went to the marketplace in Pergamum or Smyrna that they were worshiping Satan. They just thought they were going to buy some things. But John's point apocalyptically is that unless people see that what's presented to them as God-given is really the result of systematic economic exploitation and political repression and murder, they are participating in the system and giving it power, giving it authority in their lives, not being able to imagine participating in an alternative economy because this economy seems so given just the way it is. And finally, this business about sorcery and all the language in Revelation 13 about being deceived or being under the influence of illusion or lies. John saw that part of worship was not just the offering of incense to Caesar, the explicit participation in the rituals, but the implicit belief that the world as it was given by Rome was God-given. It's a little different, but related to the powerlessness. It's not so much the feeling of despair, it's the feeling of religious awe in the face of it. Of not seeing it as whore and beast, of seeing it as glorious and beautiful, and just going, wow. You see a little of that in Mark's gospel, for example, when the disciples of Jesus make their first and only journey to Jerusalem. And what's the disciples' response?
What big stones.
Yeah, Master, look at those stones. Wow. It's impressive, Yeah, and Part of that is to say that's a religious response. And Jesus' response is, not one of these stones is going to be left on another. It's all coming down. That's the response of Mark's gospel. And the disciples, can't believe it. They're taken in by the fact that temple, which Jesus sees in Mark's gospel as being, a tool of the evil one, is something from God. So in the Roman province of Asia, the question of just being in awe of the power of empire, not just in despair by it, like just going, wow, gee whiz, is part of imperial worship. On the other side, I just want to point out a couple of elements of worship in New Jerusalem. One is, and the central one is this, is the proclamation, all the songs and proclamations in the heavenly liturgy, the Lord God Almighty reigns. God is the only king. God is in charge. Despite all the appearances of the contrary, we proclaim the only one who is really in charge of life is the Creator. A second element here, again from the heavenly liturgies, is the sense of the Christians gathered together are an empire, but obviously a different kind of empire than demonic imperial, a Roman empire, and not a beastly empire. An empire in the sense of, it says, they are reigning now. Not about the future, not about some time when there's retribution and, you know, the tables are turned and Christians get to, you know, stomp their overlords, you know, under their feet. But to say right now in the cities, in the midst of the experience of poverty for those who've been faithful, is also the experience of reigning, of knowing that you are, in a way, the divine image amongst you in your little fledgling community. Okay. And it's, therefore, an empire of priests, again from Revelation 5, which is to say that there isn't priestly authority that intervenes for you to perform religious rituals so you can be okay with the Creator. You couldn't do that on your own, you know, in the Jerusalem temple. You had to have an intermediary for you. The same in the Roman imperial cult, where you had to go to one of the various kinds of imperial priests to intercede for you. This is everywhere where sacred authority is dispersed among the people. You know, recalling, like all of Revelation, something from Hebrew scripture, in this case, the Exodus proclamation by Moses, would that all of God's people were priests and prophets. Okay. So, authority to mediate the divine for one another, dispersed throughout the community, not held within an elite that, as Jack was pointing out yesterday in his analysis of liberation theology, part of the colonial theology that offers priesthood as a baptism of the status quo and someone who holds on to this authority that you don't have access to because you're poor. And finally, this image is always part of who is worshiping. In my language, not Revelations, but taking from theirs, this multilingual, multicultural, multinational multitude. There's a sense there that all of the people, as they are as different peoples, with each of their indigenous cultures, is a part of God's community. Not this imperial tendency to crush everyone else's culture in terms of your culture, to say you're not fully human unless your way of life is like ours. In Revelation in New Jerusalem, everybody gets to be part of God's community as peoples, as separate cultures that speak separate languages, each respected, arising out literally out of the soil in which people live, each having their own traditions and having each of those traditions honored. Okay? That's the kind of paradigm of worship, which is to say that what's going to look like, and it is at some level a political social discussion, you know, this is Bible study, so it has to have at least a veneer of Bible connected to it. You know, John's apocalyptic vision is what appear to be simply political economic decisions are decisions about worship. Are just questions about who is God and what does it mean to give authority to one God or another God or gods. Okay? So, what I'd like to open this up to now is first on the Babylon side, then we'll look at the New Jerusalem side. You know, where is empire now? If anywhere. You know, we start off acknowledging that in the past, empires claimed that title proudly. You know, the British Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, others, all were happy. You know, the sun never sets on the British Empire. It was a proud accomplishment to claim. As far as I'm aware, there are no entities today that claim to be empire. So we've got to read past the non-labels a little bit to see whether the description of the great city or Babylon as it's laid out in Revelation matches any kind of realities in our world, despite the fact that they're not named that way. Okay. So, your thoughts. I'll just put them up here and then we'll see what we come up with.
Governments.
Any particular government? All government?
Communism.
Communism? What were you thinking of when you said government?
Well, I mean, even in the United States, you know, I often think about all of the taxes that we pay, and I translate that into my life energy
That's
being sucked away into the mass bureaucracy.
Okay. Communism or U.S. government? Yeah.
In Edmonton is the West Edmonton Mall, the biggest shopping mall in the world. And they offer special weekend packages where you get a very cheap airline, you can stay in their hotel that's right in the mall. And now they've copied it in Minneapolis, the Mall of America.
So what do you want to say, the mall itself, or is there a force behind the mall that you like? Is the mall it? Is the mall empire, or is the mall an expression of some other kind of empire?
Consumerism.
see. I'll just, since you said the mall, I'll just put it up as an image. Consumerism.
The power of advertising, which uses violence and sex in increasing doses.
Okay, advertising, and in particular, its use of violence and sex. Okay, others.
Microsoft.
Microsoft. Getting close to home for me now.
I know, Amazon.
You're going to criticize my cup? I was waiting for some. Despite the fact they're all lowercase, you know. All right. I'll just be a scribe here and not evaluate.
The secular media.
Secular media. Others.
Multinational corporations.
Multinational corporations. Okay. Any more?
Pro sports.
Pro sports. Interesting.
Yeah. Drug industry.
Like pharmaceuticals or like illegal drugs.
Okay.
Okay.
The stock market.
What's that?
Stock market.
Stock market.
Healthcare system.
Healthcare system.
Yeah, just how insurance companies are limiting what tests doctors can do.
Okay.
So maybe it's insurance companies.
Okay. We could go on like this for a while, obviously. It's interesting to see how many things you think are imperial in our world. I'd like to try and gather all of us together, really, under one banner, which is what we've done in our book. And I think it expresses something as where the overarching power is, of which many of these are vehicles and expressions, necessary so, but not empire in themselves, although multinational corporations are getting close to it. And that's under the rubric of global capital. And we need to recognize, when Revelation's talking about empire, you know, it's not talking specifically about any particular institution, you know, that comprises empire itself. It's talking about, you know, a system that's bigger than, you know, the Roman imperial cult in particular, for example, which is, but some of these things I think are suggestions, they're expressions of empire, but they're not empire themselves. They're each of these by themselves, whether it's Microsoft, pro sports, particular industries, mall, etc., you know, do not control the world and not purport to control the world. But they're expressions of this force, that for lack of a better term, are referred to as global capital. And what I'd like to suggest, and just refer you to some resources that are in our book and in this publication that I only have one more copy of, but it's available at our website. I also work at Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center, and the journal I edit, it's called The Matter of Spirit, the current issue, is on global economics, and so some of the materials are in this little 12-page journal. It's on our website at ipjc.org, so you can see it there and read it there and such. But one of the books that I find most helpful for showing us some of this, and it's only one of a number, but I will put it up there because I think it's accessible and clear, is by an author named David Corton, called When Corporations Rule the World. He's originally from New York City, happens to live in Bainbridge Island, Washington right now. So those of you in the Northwest, he's going to be speaking as well at in Seattle at the end of September. David Corton has about as elegant a pedigree as you could imagine for being part of the establishment of such things. He's a former MBA professor at Stanford and Harvard, has his doctorate from Harvard, I believe. Worked for 10 years for USAID and development work around the world. You know, and somewhere along the line, in about his mid-50s, after having spent a career, you know, teaching people how the world worked in terms of what he was taught, defected from it. And his defection was a result of his belief that after working in development work, he wasn't making things better, but making them worse. And he began to question the entire system that he worked in his whole life. And he's created a new center whose name I forget at the moment. If any of you know, feel free to name it. That's trying to help people see this and see alternatives. So this book is filled with, you know, wonderfully documented information that I can just barely begin to summarize. But if you think I'm just throwing things off the top of my head, it's from Corton and it's all very clear. As well as he's just not the only person who's laying some of this stuff out. If we look in our country, you know, the history of the United States, we see that the question of corporate control and the relationship between corporations and governments goes back to really the root of the country. It goes back to the colonial struggle with the East India Trading Company and the Hudson Bay Company, which are the main corporate, you know, crown chartered vehicles of the British Empire in North America. As a means to try and, you know, not reproduce that in this country, corporations were chartered by state governments. Some of you may well know this, but just to get it on the table. And the purpose of the corporate charter was to limit the corporation, which of course is a legal entity, it doesn't exist except by law, to authority granted by the state. And to give the state the capacity to say if the corporation extends its power beyond its specific charter, the charter can be revoked and the corporation dies. Okay. The relationship between the state power to revoke corporate charters and corporations was in great jeopardy as early as, well, it's all along, but explicitly as early as Abraham Lincoln, who's quoted as saying, you know, we're in danger of becoming a government not of the people, by the people, for the people, but of corporations, by corporations, and for corporations. Now, Lincoln said that in 1862. You know, it's not one of the quotes we usually get from Abraham Lincoln, but there it is. It's in our book, too, so you can see the source. It was an issue way back then. It's been an issue all along. But, and one of the major struggles, rare struggles, between corporations and government for authority was around the turn of the century when the great trusts were ostensibly broken up, the oil trusts and, you know, some of the other steel trusts. I used to be an antitrust lawyer, as some of you know, so I've been there, done that one. But I'd like to focus now on what Corton shows is the systematic movement of power from governments to corporations starting in 1948. And this is in the aftermath of World War II, and some of this, for those of you who've been at Jack Nelson Pallmeyer sessions, will overlap a little bit of what he's presented from the issue perspective of foreign policy. This is a parallel movement happening in terms of economic structure, you know, by the same people at the same time. You know, in the aftermath of World War II, one of the main desires of the United States and the Western Allies was to rebuild Japan and Germany so their economies could become stable and so they wouldn't fall to communism, etc. But primarily so they could be part of the Western free market. Well, perhaps to people's surprise, perhaps not, Germany and Japan rebuilt and became stable very quickly. So a couple of the institutions that had been built to help reestablish Germany and Japan's economy found themselves all dressed up with no place to go. Anybody know what those major institutions were?
Marshall Plan.
Well, Marshall Plan was the scheme, but the two major institutions were developed.
World Bank.
And the other one was its partner,
IMF.
The IMF, International Monetary Fund. And created to be the military enforcement arm of the World Bank, the IMF, was NATO. The World Bank and IMF obviously were just paper entities, otherwise, men in suits, you know, who could make decisions, but without some kind of force to back them up, they didn't have a lot of power. Along with the building of these institutions was a really powerful characterization of the rest of the world that is with us to this day. And again, this goes into some of what Jack was talking about on Monday in terms of the myth of the benevolent superpower. And that was during Truman's time, his advisors came up with a way of extending World Bank and IMF economic power beyond Germany and Japan by thinking of the rest of the world as underdeveloped countries, and that we would help them become developing countries. Right. Now, what kind of relationship does that suggest between, you know, us and them, if you will? If we in the West and Europe and North America are developed countries, and they are undeveloped or underdeveloped countries.
Superior and subordinate. Superior and subordinate.
Superior and subordinate?
It's empire all over again.
Empire all over again. And yet, does it, you know, does that ring, as Jack was suggesting, of benevolence? Paternalistic. Okay. It's, you know, Revelation would see it as a demonic religious act. It's creating, trying to create the world in our image. Taking that, you know, God-given creative power of creating the world in the divine image, creating human beings in the divine image. This was trying to create the world in our image. And most of us, I'm sure, grew up with the idea that that was a good thing, that we were helping people. These poor, quote-unquote, primitive societies who didn't have all the good things that we had, from things that we think absolutely basic, of running water and electricity and you know, the staples of modern industrial life, to the things that aren't the staples but are deemed necessary, like Coca-Cola and McDonald's and all that kind of stuff. It's important to see that this was an explicitly decided characterization in order to give the IMF and World Bank power in the rest of the world. This labeling of the two-thirds world as underdeveloped and in need of development. And this is precisely the work that Corton did for years, development work, which when he saw it up close thought, we're destroying these people, we're not helping them at all. Now, I can't go into, in the time we have now, the entire history of the IMF and the World Bank. That's been laid out by all kinds of people. Corton has a little bit of it in his book, and there's many places that have laid out the history. Some of the worst effects was the policy of structural adjustment, which was an attempt to leverage the debt given to, especially in Latin America and other places, into systematic transformation of local economies and societies away from local cultures into engines for economic export. And so we see some of the extremes of that, for example, in Mexico, where Mexico has to import corn and beans to feed itself. You know, Mexico is now dependent on imports for the basic staples of daily life, which obviously indigenous people provided for themselves forever, as long as there have been people in what we call Mexico. Now they're dependent upon it for imports for that. And their economies, similarly, are vehicles for export. It's the global economy. Now, when Jack was talking yesterday about liberation theology, when he was giving the example of what a wealthy landowner in Latin America would want as a career for his son, he noted a number of things, you know, military leadership, merchant, landowner, priest. Priest within the colonial theology that, you know, said the world as is God-given. One could, if one wanted to, I thought Jack might do it yesterday, I'll do it now, equate the colonial theology with, you know, Babylon, with imperial theology. That's what it is. But Jack noted yesterday that they would not urge their children to be politicians because politicians didn't have any power. Politicians were the window dressing behind the real sources of power, which is, you know, the engines of commerce and the military that supported it, and the church, which gave legitimation to it. Okay, that's relatively easy for us to accept in Latin America. I'd suggest and invite you to consider what's often harder for us to suggest, which is the same is true here. You know, I used to work in the U.S. Senate. My experience is not social science, it's just my experience. But what my experience showed me there was that, at least at the national level, maybe it's not true at your local town or city, but at least at the national level, that the idea that there's democracy, that you really have a choice in what the policies are, is an illusion. That corporations, as Corton says, run the show. And that all the rituals, which are religious rituals about voting, to not vote is to be a heretic. You know, to the religious rituals about choosing between two corporate promoted candidates is not democracy. You know, it's not a choice among policies. And for many people, it's becoming self-evident. You know, as we see politicians like Bill Clinton, who make a science out of having no viewpoint at all, but only do what they're told. And again, I could give you hundreds of examples of concrete evidence of that. We don't have time for that now. So if this seems like rhetoric, I just hope you'll trust me at this point that there's basis for it, and I'm not just saying these things without some support. So if that's the case, then we have to say, what is the effect of this? How is this like Babylon? Just a couple of anecdotal examples. One is the export-import business, of the destruction of local economies and turning them into dependent engines. You know, one of our hardest struggles to show how embedded we are in this, and the conversation came up earlier this week is around the fact that we've made local economies around the rest of the world so dependent on these transnational, again, I'd say global corporations, someone said multinational corporations. I think that's not the precisely correct term these days. Multinational referred to corporations grounded in one country that learned how to operate within the ethnic culture and system of other countries. Global corporations are corporations which transform local environments to suit their needs. And that's the situation we're in now. It's not corporations adapting to local needs, it's corporations adapting the local culture to their needs. One of the struggles we see is how dependent they've become on this system, so we can almost not imagine restoring local self-sustaining economies to most of the world. An example came up when I was doing a workshop with someone who's been involved with sweatshops, and it was part of a campaign to deal with Disney in Haiti, where many of the Disney toys and things are produced in sweatshops. And I think Jack's showing a video about sweatshops today that'll show some of this in detail. Don't know about Disney, but others. And their campaign was urged around getting Disney to provide fair labor conditions and fair wages to people working to produce Mickey Mouse ears and such. Disney's response was to withdraw from Haiti. And this advocate against sweatshops was lamenting that and saying, you know, they've taken away the jobs they provided, now the people are left with nothing. And I would suggest that that's not having the point of view that Revelation is calling us to. Revelation's viewpoint, I think, would call us to say, good riddance, Disney. Even though in the short term, it's incredibly painful when you become addicted to empire to go through the withdrawal pains. But Haiti, for all its poverty, was relatively self-sufficient for a long time before Disney came along and baseball producing factories and such. So to withdraw from Babylon in this context would be to invite back to a situation where people are no longer dependent on the global economy, which is a situation we can almost not imagine anymore. So enthralled are we to the beast. Okay? That's some of the Babylon side of it. One more piece of that, and I'll switch us to the New Jerusalem side of it. And that's this piece about deceived by its sorceries. One of the most powerful effects of the global economy, I think, is the proliferation of images, icons of culture. Hollywood, Michael Jordan, MTV, Coke, McDonald's, that define the good life for people. You know, in addition to destroying the local economies and taking away their jobs and independent economic dependence, they define reality, define life. The president of Coke explicitly said, Coca-Cola is the thing that unites the world. It's the most known image around the planet. And he proudly noted how in the last Olympics, how much they paid for their commercials, which were seen by almost 3 billion people. And of course, what's their slogan? I'd like to buy the world a Coke. That same guy, by the way, speaking to a different audience, was talking about the possibilities of Coca-Cola expansion into Indonesia. And he says, when I look out at Indonesia, a country whose average age of its citizens is 25 and has a Muslim ban on alcohol, I feel like I'm looking at heaven. Now that's a statement from the president of Coke. Again, I could proliferate this stuff endlessly. You know, one of the ones that I like because of its horror is MTV, music television, which has it as a slogan, MTV provides reason to live. Okay? Once you start to see this, you see that it's not just a matter of destroying the local economies, it's a matter of creating a mindset by which we're taken in to believe that this is the best of all possible worlds. This is progress. This is development. This is good. Anybody who challenges it is, you know, is crazy, possessed. You know that how craziness is used as a way of demonizing in our culture, branding as mentally ill. It's what used to be done under the label heresy outside the community. Now it's often they're crazy. Or communists, another label that's used totally apart from its real meaning to brand people as heretics.
My favorite this spring was the bank in Portland that put out big flyers that said, we're going to honor Memorial Day this year by staying open.
One that I liked while you're on that one is in Seattle. One of the big retailers is Nordstrom's. And a group of us who were doing a little anti-Christmas shopping thing one winter noted that in beautiful gold script on the window at Nordstrom's was this phrase, "We have the spirit of Christmas all wrapped up." I pictured the spirit of Christmas gagged and bound in the back room of Nordstrom's. So again, you know, we could go on with this, but I want, this is just an overview. If you don't believe some of this, feel free to ask me about the documentation later or some of the sources. If this much is true, you know, if this is where empire exists today, not so much in government, but government simply as a vehicle to enforce the arrangements of global capital, which one point just to add, which I forgot to mention, you know. Systematically made into law through some of the international treaties like NAFTA, you know, which is an incredible vehicle for transferring wealth from the poor to the rich. People know about MAI? Anybody know about MAI, the Multinational Agreement on Investments? It doesn't exist yet. It's in negotiation in various stages. The very fact that you don't know about it just shows how powerful some of this stuff is. MAI is a system under which corporations under the vehicle created under MAI, would be entitled to sue governments for having laws that interfere with international trade. And anything, whether it's occupational safety, environment, minimum wage, any of those things that are deemed to be impediments upon international trade would be illegal under MAI. Okay. That's when corporations rule the world. And really, in many ways, we're unless we suddenly rise up in great great numbers, not likely to stop MAI. MAI is NAFTA wrought large on the world. Okay, so it's legalized into the system, but a system which, you know, under MAI, there's no right of appeal. The hearings are held behind closed doors. There's no right to public access to the documents and all that kind of stuff. Okay, it just happens behind the scenes. That's what apocalyptic is about, is to lift the veil on that and show it. So if this is any kind of a paradigm that makes sense, that says that this world that John saw in first century Asia does exist in our world, then what does that mean for us? As people trying to be followers of Jesus, coming out of this system somehow into New Jerusalem, into a different system, do we even have the imagination, as John tried to inculcate in his communities with the New Jerusalem vision, to believe that God doesn't reign over this system, but there is an alternative that God does reign over that offers to us as gift, not as the work of our hands? Signs of New Jerusalem in our midst.
Holden.
What awful one. Holden. Funny, the same thing came up in the first session. All right. Now, I love Holden like you do. Let's note how dependent Holden is on the imperial economy. Like, we'd be eating shrubs and roots otherwise.
Tailings,
yeah, right. So Holden is a nice image, but let's be honest about the reality here. Other examples from your local communities or things you know about?
Ted Kaczynski.
This is a sign of New Jerusalem. You're from Montana, aren't you? You want to say something about that, Mark?
He's in my local community. I mean, he's battling empires.
He's battling empire. Would you say that Ted? No, you don't.
The priesthood of believers.
Okay. What does that mean? What exactly does that concretely say?
It's all of us that believe and worship God.
Yeah.
And have him as number one in our lives.
So what does that mean in terms of our stuff? You know, Revelation, interestingly, has, although it's about worship, is ultimately concerned with stuff. That's part of an expression of that. That's why in Revelation 18, there's an incredibly long cargo list. You know, okay?
I was thinking of Habitat for Humanity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Habitat's one nice example. Others?
CSAs, Communities for Agriculture.
Now, Carol, I didn't set you up on this, but that's why I'm wearing this T-shirt today. So I was glad you said that. You know, people know what community supported agriculture is?
Yeah.
For those who don't, it's basically a system by which, 95% of food in the American stores is produced by corporate agribusiness. CSAs is a way to work outside of that, by which farmers, instead of, you know, being dependent on the market for pricing, it's also known as subscription farming. People buy a share of the produce at a fixed price, and whatever the farm produces, and they're almost always organic farms, then you share in that. If the weather is bad, then you share in the risk as well. And that way the farmers get money at the beginning of the season, you know, to do their planting and such. And, you know, you participate in it, so it's community supported rather than leaving the farmer dependent on government supports or corporate loans, etc. I wore this shirt to give one, I'll get to yours in a second, to give one example of how a CSA can be part of a broader thing, just to get your imagination going. For those who can't see, this shirt is from Guadalupe House, which is the Tacoma, Washington Catholic Worker community. Tacoma Catholic Workers in a part of Tacoma called the Hilltop, which is historically been one of the poorest, most crime-ridden parts of Tacoma. There are two houses, which are two old kind of crumbling houses joined together, run a block where there are many abandoned and empty lots filled with, you know, broken glass and abandoned cars and drug paraphernalia and all that kind of stuff. And many of the older people who lived on the block for years, who owned their homes because they bought them cheap, were afraid to go out day or night, were kind of prisoners in their own homes. And Catholic Workers' primary mission is to house homeless people and to provide hospitality in the Catholic Worker tradition. But they looked out at one of these empty lots behind them. Their houses were here, and there's an alley. There was an older widow who lived here, and next to her was a lot that was part of her property. And they went to her and said, could we grow some things on your empty lot and use your water, and we'll share some of the produce with you? And she said, sure. No. And to make this long story short, over several years, the success of that one lot developed into, on their block, 9 lots. So they now have, I think, about 2.5 or close to 3 acres of urban organic farming right in the middle of the, what had been the most degraded part of Tacoma. And they operate it as a CSA. And they hire as workers at just wages formerly homeless people. So they don't pay farm workers' wages. They pay them $8 an hour, you know, to work right there in their backyard. And then people from all over the Tacoma area come once a week to enjoy the beauty and splendor of the gardens, as well as to pick up organically produced produce to bring home with them. So it gets people to see the Hilltop who otherwise didn't even know it existed or just heard rumors about it. And therefore also to develop relationships with the workers and with the Tacoma Catholic Worker, etc. I just think it's a marvelous example of how, you know, problems of homelessness, you know, environmental issues, farming, fair wages can all, with a little imagination, be, you know, produced into a win-win situation. Okay, others?
I don't know if it's a CSA, but I know through Lutheran World Relief we can buy coffee that comes from the coffee growers without the middleman.
Okay, very good. And like Holden provides, Coffee Mom. People haven't noticed, the coffee here is organic coffee produced by fair wage co-ops, shade grown to protect songbirds. Again, one of those things where both environmental issues and issues of human dignity and work are combined. Yeah.
The various co-ops, the bison co-op, durum wheat co-op, pork co-ops.
Co-ops, you know, which had their modern root in Mondragon, Spain. Do people know about Mondragon? Mondragon, yeah, there's some wonderful books and stories written about Mondragon. But inspired by a local priest, a company that was going to go out of business, the priest convinced the company to allow the workers to have a hand at running the business. And they did, and they developed a whole series of co-ops and relationships, giving a model not of communism, you know, but of worker-owned businesses that provided for the local economy. Montreal's quite a wonderful story.
Well, I live, there's a group of dairy farms. I live in Western Massachusetts where the dairy farms have been bought away. And they band together and label their milk together. So they actually made a milk co-op with a local, only locally used milk in it.
So dairy and produce, there are many different kinds of co-ops that we could, yeah.
Where would you put credit union.
Okay. I think credit unions are the money equivalent of a co-op. Just to take your imagination one step farther on that, you know, there are many credit unions that you can only be a member of if you're an employee, or I happen to be still a member of the Washington State Employees Credit Union, even though I haven't worked for the state in 15 years now. Boeing in our area has one and many others. One step that some economies have taken to take this one step further is the development of local currencies. Now, some of you may have heard of this through in Ithaca, New York, where Cornell University is. They have a thing called Ithaca Hours. And with Ithaca Hours, which now several hundred merchants take as money, everybody's hourly work is worth the same. So whether you go to the dentist, or the grocer, or the car mechanic, everybody gets an Ithaca hour for an hour's worth of work. And it's obviously a voluntary system. You know, merchants only take them if, you know, to the extent that it's good. But it's part of a system that's systematized. I forget the author. Some of you may know lives in Vancouver, just outside Vancouver, British Columbia, who's written a whole book about developing local currencies. One lovely example of this is in the town of, put that up, local currencies. In Mullaney, Australia, Queensland, Australia, an area which had been small farms and kind of a retirement community for people outside of Brisbane. Some folks, for secular reasons, but kind of for environmental reasons, moved out there. They developed a series of dairy and other production co-ops, a credit union, and then moved to developing a local currency. And the local currency is so stable that the Australian government has gone to them for help. Because the Australian government saw how tightly bound their currency was with the Asian currency markets, and saw that if there's another Asian currency problem, Australian dollar could be in trouble. So they've gone to Mullaney to get information about that. Now, an interesting twist on this whole business is, I learned about Mullaney through a book by an Irish economist named Richard Douthwaite, which is a wonderful compendium of these things. His book is called Short Circuit. It's his follow-up on a book he called The Growth Illusion. You know, the title explains the story. Short Circuit is a collection of analyses of local economic projects, from credit unions to local currencies to local energy production and various things, where he, with his hard-headed economic viewpoint, says, this is what worked about it, this is what doesn't work about it. This is what you can do in your backyard, this is what it takes 100 people to do. And he analyzed Mullaney for its advantages and disadvantages. Shows it's not perfect, but it's got some interesting things. Now, this just shows how full circle it is. I found out about this book through Amazon.com. I bought it. Remember, he's Irish. This is in Australia. My co-author, Anthony, lives 30 miles from this place. He'd never heard of it. He heard of it from me. So it went from Amazon to Ireland to Seattle back to Australia. Which is all to say that I'm not saying here, a couple people were asking in the first session this morning, you're not saying that technology is bad, are you? Or that we should all live with, you know, hand plows or something? No. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that because Revelation isn't saying that. Revelation obviously isn't passing on the question of computers. But it's to say the issue isn't Ludditism. It's not some romantic fantasy about, you know, a simpler past. It's not back to the Garden of Eden. Revelation's image, as I was suggesting yesterday, is transplanting Eden into the city. So it's acknowledging all the development of cities, which are not, you know, as simple as a primitively imagined garden. So the question isn't, should we not use the internet? Should we not use computers or any kind of modern conveniences? The issue is, how are those things produced? Are they produced, you know, by and for labor that's, you know, treating the earth and human beings with dignity and respect for the common good, or is it produced as a vehicle of exploitation to increase the wealth of a few on behalf of the many? It's not a matter of broad statements about certain kinds of things are bad and certain kinds of things are good. You know, John doesn't do that, I'm not suggesting that either. Just briefly, any others that we might have to add to this list of hope?
Families.
Okay, what about families?
Well, I guess in the nurturing and training of children to grow up to have ideas that are not lockstep with the mass culture.
Okay, so families can be a site in which, you know, empire is resisted. You know, I know with an 8-year-old how that's a daily struggle.
Yeah.
Daily struggle. You know, we happen to send our kid to our local Catholic school, which makes not a whit of difference in terms of these issues. You know, all his friends have all the goodies, and he wants Lunchables and all that stuff, which I just think are, I just tell him, Lunchables are from the devil, Peter. It's definitely one of the places of struggle. And the other is, as I was suggesting yesterday, is church. Which I hope, if nothing else, have at least piqued your imagination to say, what would it mean to treat the church, the ecclesia, as a place not just of religious rituals, but a place where those rituals proclaimed an allegiance to God that led us to live as church? Some of this. You know, people refer to some, you know, church-based organizations, but that's not what I think Revelation is referring to, not to say these are bad, but to say, how could your local congregation learn to develop a sustainable, just economy? We almost cannot imagine it. We almost cannot imagine getting from here to there. And the issue isn't suddenly dropping everything that we do and going to some reality that doesn't appear to exist. But Revelation's insistent images that New Jerusalem is not our creation, it comes as a gift. The hard work that we have to do is coming out of Babylon. We don't have to create New Jerusalem. God has already made it, it's just there. Once we come out of Babylon, we see that it's there.
Wes, could you say something about one of the places where some people would say they find New Jerusalem is the white right-wing militia movements who are, they're very apocalyptic in a somewhat different sense, but they would say they're unveiling reality and that the federal government is Satan. And,
sure.
And they have this convoluted notion of Jesus and convoluted.
Yeah. Many millennial groups, as I was suggesting way back in the first session last week, are resistant to American culture and the dominant culture of our society. Their prescription, though, is not grounded in reading Revelation in its own terms. Their prescription is grounded in reading Revelation in light of one of the various millennial, you know, forms of tribulationism, pre, mid, or post, depending upon how you, you know, interpret that. And I suggest all of those are misreading the book inherently. So whether it's the survivalists, who are usually representative of the mid or post-tribulationists, those who think that the rapture won't come until after the Antichrist has had 3.5 years of evil reign. Therefore, hunker down in your bunkers with your guns, and because if we're going to survive to the rapture, we're going to have to shoot our way out. You know, that's simply the logical outcome of mid or post-tribulationism. And I suggest, as I did at the beginning, and that's back in the first chapter of our book, and on the tape from Monday last week, that all of that comes from failing to take seriously Revelation within its context in Hebrew scripture and in the imperial world out of which it came. That's why, for those who were here last week, it took me till Friday to where we even start to read the book of Revelation. Because we start to jump too quickly to the text and say, what does it mean without understanding its world? We can easily get swept up in some of these false readings. So thanks for raising that point, Jack. Anybody, one or two others that are your favorites you just want to add to the hope list?
Hospice movement.
Okay, hospice. Dying with dignity. That, you know, is of course a response to someone's noting the healthcare system down here, the darker side of things where, you know, we don't accept death as a part of life and allow people to die with dignity.
Classrooms that are commercial free zones.
Even the fact that we have to say that just shows how deep it is, huh? I was reading in one of the books that I have on here about how classrooms, and there's a Coke machine in Peter's Catholic school, which, but were using the roofs of their buildings as advertising. Companies were paying them to put big ads on the roof so that airplanes flying overhead could see it. You know, and where governments have cut back on public financing of education, schools are desperate and saying, well, why not? What's the harm in that? So I'll just put schools here and fill that in. One last example from my experience that I think connects some of this in a positive way. Maybe it'll give us a little imagination. People named Habitat for Humanity. Some friends of ours went to Malawi to do a habitat project a couple summers ago. If you don't know, Malawi is a very poor country in the middle of Africa where AIDS is rampant. I forget the numbers, but it's like 30 to 40% of adult men have AIDS or HIV positive. It's a country that's been rife with military-imposed violence. The Catholic bishops a few years ago were threatened with mass assassination, and a plot was in place, and if someone had squealed, all the bishops in Malawi, I think there's seven of them, would have been killed. The bomb was in place, they managed to escape it. So it's a place, as Jack's been referring to, like Latin America, with a terrible poverty and political oppression, and yet the village that our friends went to, connected with Habitat, was a village of Christian people, struggling to say, what does it mean to be Christian in the midst of AIDS, and poverty, and political violence? And our friends expressed a remarkable experience. They were there for a month, probably the only white people ever to be in this distant outpost, with none of the things that we think essential for life. You know, no electricity, no running water, no marketplace, people just eating very simple root crops and such. You're literally dirt poor. And they said, in a month, we never heard a baby crying. Now that just really struck me, you know? Because, you know, I have a kid who cries when he doesn't get ice cream every day. Here at Holden. And they, you know, there they were, amidst nothing. And they were joyous. And he said, you know, they didn't have to worry about shuttling their kids to daycare and the high cost of daycare. They didn't have daycare. If the kid wandered a little ways down the street, someone picked the kid up and brought them back. Or played with them for a while. The kids were the community's kids. You know? And our friends, you know, without romanticizing their situation at all, their situation is terribly oppressive and uncomfortable. Most of us would feel like, how could people live under those circumstances? And yet, they found joy. They found community. And their kids were shining-faced and happy, despite the fact they barely had food to eat, and many of their fathers would never live to old age. So, I don't know about you, but I just find that shakes up my whole world here, and I think it's part of the apocalyptic reversal that Revelation is trying to point us at. To the extent we're shocked by that kind of anecdote, it might say just how taken in by the imperial illusion we've been, that the way the world is the way the world's supposed to be. So I need to stop here at 9:59. On behalf of people who've been here for 2 weeks, I want to thank all of you for grappling with this text that many of us have never dealt with before, for being willing to take seriously its challenges. You know, it's always been an incredibly challenging text, not just because it's mysterious, but because it goes to the heart of where our faith and our loyalties are. I don't find living it out any easier than perhaps you do, so I don't read this text and teach it with any sense of holier than thou at all. And yet, I'd like to take seriously, as I think John did, every small step we make, thinking about it, praying about it, acting on it somehow, to take one step today to become citizens of New Jerusalem and give up our citizenship in Babylon. So thank you all for coming. Again, if you're interested in the book, it's there, and hope to see some of you in other parts of New Jerusalem.